I'm tempted to say that this is a ridiculous formulation.
I'm just reminded there's a film called Subway that I saw years and years ago with Christophe Lambert, and it had a series of quotes at the beginning, and the first one said, "To do is to be Aristotle." And then afterwards it flashed up, "To be is to do Jean-Paul Sartre." And then it said, "Dooby dooby dooby doo Sinatra," which I thought was about right for that.
Yeah. And maybe right for this.
Yeah. There seems to be a changeover in that bit as well as in this bit.
Right,
so we're
not,
that a second.
And we have to just keep talking because we...
Our time is running.
I want to ask you something really straightforward.
Okay, what is your name and where are you from?
No. I want to say, yes, tell me, Dan. I wanted to talk to Dan because he's at the Welcome and he does public... He's Mr. Scientist, if you want to understand something. He's got a little shingle outside his door that says scientist instead of barber. And if there's something you want to understand, you can go and talk to Dan. And he's done some quite interesting, by which I mean very interesting, collaborations with... What's it called? SciPo? What is it called at the Photographer's Gallery that you do?
Well, there's Café Scientifique at the Photographer's... So, I mean, good morning. My name is Daniel Glazer. I'm by training a neuroscientist, but what I'm interested in, as Susie says, is doing science in a non-science space. And for me, I guess that began... I was at the ICA in 2002 as the scientist in residence, which, through no fault of mine, was the first time there'd been a scientist in residence at an arts institution in the world, and that was about doing it outside the space. And we do Café Scientifique at Photographer's Gallery and all across UK, which again is taking science and putting it into a domain which is, or a space which is controlled by non-scientists. And your sort of reluctance, Jeanette, to engage, you know, to even feel able to answer the question of whether you're pissed off about the fact that you don't get to criticise science. Like, all of that was beyond. That's what I'm trying to reverse. By taking these conversations into spaces that are controlled by people who aren't scientists. So that's cafes or art galleries or... cultural venues.
And I guess what's useful about that, because I participated in one of those, is that in my case, it was with a neuroscientist.
Yeah, Ashish Rampura, who I run it with, who's great.
Has the capacity to think deeply enough about his area that he can convey it so that it's comprehensible for more than the second that you're listening. Mm-hmm. And I think that that comes not from being a good communicator, which is what people say, which I always think is the biggest put down in the world, but from very, very deep understanding. So I'm going to ask Dan a very, what I think is quite a clean question, but he's probably going to disabuse me of the notion, because I think we, with the picture that's going on in the world about neuroscience, and brain science and imaging, etc. I think there's and in my field, the whole of turning of psychoanalysis into neurospeak, which we can talk about in a minute if we need to. I want you to give me a sense, and everybody here, of the difference between brain and mind, dare I put in body, from your perspective, because I think that might help inform our conversation.
Yeah.
I'll be taking notes during this.
That's good. So it's funny, I remember there was an In Our Time, Melvyn Bragg was doing one on memory.
Yeah.
Okay. And so this is an answer to why I can't answer the question in a part. And he said, it was one about memory, and they had a few memory experts, and he says, just before we kick off, can you just outline for us, you know, how memory basically works? Why do we forget stuff, you know, roughly speaking? What's the difference between having remembered something and then forgetting it versus never having remembered it at all? And where in the brain is all that happening, right? And there was this kind of pause, you know, for laughter. Now, the reason why that's funny to neuroscientists is interesting, but let me contrast it with the following. Imagine Melvyn Bragg was doing respiration, okay? So he's doing In Our Time on respiration. He would say at the beginning, can you just outline for us how respiration works, how the oxygen gets from the air to the muscles, what hemoglobin is for, what happens when you don't have enough hemoglobin, and what the oxygen is doing once it gets to the muscles. Oh, and yeah, what's the waste of the carbon dioxide? How does that get out? And the answer is, yes, I can do that. You know, you give me 2 minutes, I will tell you. Hemoglobin is a transport mechanism. Oxygen is part of an energy reaction. It comes out of the atmosphere. If you don't get it, the muscles die. And I can actually do it for respiration, right, in a way that I couldn't begin to do it for memory. So there is something interestingly different.
I was giving you
different.
Thinking time
Thank
there
you.
For you to get to brain and
yeah,
mind.
Yeah. So there is an interesting difference between asking questions like that about some forms of science and other forms of science. There are forms of science where we can answer the question, what is the difference between mass and weight? can do that one. What's the difference between brain and mind? Not sure I can do it, right? And I can tell you why I think I can't.
Yeah,
but I'm not going to be able to get you to the place that I could get you with mass and weight or with respiration. Because there isn't a story I can end up with that will make you feel satisfied as you would about mass and weight.
But is that because it's being reconceptualized?
Right.
Because I think that's probably where the confusion is at this moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the answer is, I mean, I like Jeanette's quote. I even tweeted it while you said it, Jeanette, if you'll forgive me, without your permission, but you'd signed something before. The mind is an unbounded condition, you said. And I think that's rather smart. And it's nice, at least in part, because it has a very mathematical connotation to mm-hmm. it. There's a mathematical sense of unbounded conditions, which is roughly speaking conditions where you can't cut them off anywhere. Right, which is to say that an unbounded function is one that never reaches zero. In mathematical terms, it asymptotes to zero. It approaches zero, but never reaches zero. And in some cases, there are ripples that will go on. As far as you look, there will still be a ripple. And that's what an unbounded condition is. That's what mind is like, too. Brain isn't like that. We know where brain is. We can measure its metabolic needs. It's bounded physically within the head. I mean, the spinal cord and the retina and so on and nerves. But, you know, we kind of know its limits. Mind, we don't. And I think that, you know, I mean, you were against Cartesian dualism in the previous conversation, the mind-body split. But I think what you hinted at in why it's a silly split is because it's always going to be, there's going to be multiple layers. I mean, if it's an onion skin or an unbounded condition. Okay? But whenever you try and limit your mind, you'll always find there's a bit outside that which you didn't get hold of. So if you say it's just me, it's in my head, but my words are words that I learned as a child or that I took from the culture. The concepts that I think are just in my head don't make sense, perhaps, if you didn't hear Jeanette's comments earlier or get Susie's question. Those questions are phrased in terms of the history of psychoanalysis or in the history of literature. You can't actually bound the mind at all. It is unboundable or unbounded. So there's a very simple sense in which the mind and the brain are different. I can put limits on the brain physically, but I don't think I can understand a mind without essentially taking everything into account to some extent.
So, in fact, they're not the same. It's a ridiculous question, is what you're saying.
Well, that's a perfectly reasonable question, but it's just that there's no easy answer. I mean, what would a reasonable answer to the question, what's the mind and brain? I mean, there are people, perhaps even people speaking later today, who will answer very stridently that there's no difference, right, or something. How would an argument go that would work? It would say, well, you know, mind, that's all fine until we understand the brain. And then when we've understood the brain, you can throw out all that mind guff. I mean, there are people who believe this, and we can just do the biology, right? There are people called eliminativists.
No.
Yes. There are. I'm sorry to tell you, Jeanette. 11 o'clock in the morning. There are people called eliminativists. The poster boy is Paul Churchland. Actually, his wife's coming to talk at Wellcome in a couple of weeks, and she has similar views, but not as strident. He says that there's this thing called belief-desire talk, right?
Oh, I like.
Which is, you know, I believe that there's a coffee in the bar afterwards and I desire coffee, so I'm going to walk towards the bar.
Okay.
And that's an account of my behaviour. It's called mm-hmm. folk psychology. And he says, that's fine just until we have a proper understanding of the brain. And once we've pinned the biology down, I'll be able to explain my walk towards the bar in terms of dopamine and nerves and that kind of stuff. And the talk about beliefs and desires will simply evaporate. The mind will no longer be a concept. It'll just be brains, and we'll understand ourselves biologically.
Well, I don't really want to spend time on what we don't believe, but
okay.
where does human agency come up for those people? I wouldn't mind you telling me that.
Okay. Well, I can tell you where agency comes in for me, if that's
okay, that's probably much better.
And also, I mean, there's a sense of timescales of change, because agency is about wanting to change stuff or changing things, being an actor, somebody who brings about a change, right? I change the position of that water. I was an agent. And I think agency in the brain is kind of an illusion. I mean, that's my own feeling about it,
mm-hmm.
right? The sense that we control ourselves, that we choose to do stuff, is a plausible post hoc fiction. It's a story we tell about ourselves, often in the immediate aftermath of a thing that's happened, to sort of reassure ourselves that we're on top of things. But and I can kind of give you reasonably good scientific evidence for that. There are some really simple Mickey Mouse experiments. Here's a really simple one, which has been done years ago, and it keeps getting redone. I can sit here and you tell me to press a button whenever I want to. Anytime I want, I just press that button. Anytime I sit here, okay, that was you telling me. But so you think that you're choosing when to push it, and there's a sense of knowing when you chose to push it. But actually, if I'm imaging your brain or in fact scanning your brain electrically, I can notice what are called readiness potentials. There's a potential thing that wells up in your brain before you're aware of it that automatically predicts when you're going to push the button. So the thought that you've chosen to push it right then You invent that thought after the choice has happened, and the choice happens without you knowing. Right? So agency, the idea that we control ourselves, is an illusion. And I'm actually quite comfortable with that, both as a neuroscientist and as a man.
But the prep, excuse me, where does the prep come from?
Oh, it's all in the head.
So the prep could be a form of agency too.
It is. It's just nothing like the agency we feel, is the point.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. That's where the problem comes to me.
Well, yeah, the problem comes with this rather inflated, egotistical sense that we should know what's going on inside our heads. I mean, we don't know what's going on inside our livers.
No, but I'm not that naive, because I do actually come out of psychoanalysis, and I do think that, I mean, and I'm also a child of the 60s who smoked dope, so I do know from, really probably from that more than from psychoanalysis, because I don't think you could know how much of experience is unconscious, but I certainly think you know when you're smoking a spliff and you're 18 or 20, that you're only tapping into such a small piece of your experience.
Right. Carrie Mullis, who's a guy who invented PCR, which is the thing which gave rise to genetic fingerprinting, got a Nobel Prize for that, also did this really active research program on the west coast of the US into psychoactive drugs. And interestingly, he treated them like a scientific experiment. They would synthesize them in the lab in the day, they would pop them around sunset, and then they would write their experiences the next day. And, you know, Coleridge had nothing. I mean, it was just like, the colors, and the lab notebook was full of these beautiful, you know, colors which they had no recollection of the next day. And one of the things he says, which is interesting, is he reckons that no one who's done a really, you know, really trippy, and I must say I've done lots of dope, but not, I haven't done acid and stuff.
That's because you're the wrong age.
Maybe. But, you know, if you've done acid stuff and really trippy stuff beyond a certain level, he's not talking loads and loads, but more than one trip, but not hundreds. He says anyone who's done that is automatically politically a liberal. He says you can't be politically a conservative if you've done a lot of psychoactive
drugs. But I think
and he says that's because you lose the sense that it's okay to tell people how to be, as conservatives might, because you just realise that what you're experiencing, this giant rabbit or toadstool, is completely, you know, woo. And once you've got that sense, it becomes difficult to impose your view on others.
Yeah, but I think that was Leary's position too. And I don't think that's accurate, because we know plenty of people who are tripping their brains out in the 60s and 70s, unfortunately, who've probably been marauding the economy and creating all these financial instruments. So no, I don't think so. I think he was a bit naive there.
I like the fact that we're both on couches, right, having this, talking to the psychoanalysis thing.
Did you want to put your legs up?
I don't know if I ought to or not. I never did the classical thing.
No, I didn't. I don't really like that. I like the possibility of looking at you.
Can I tell you a funny story about couches? So in the Trust, we had an exhibition on, was it Madness and Modernity, and we wanted to get Freud's couch.
I know. I'm a trustee in the museum.
So you guys said it was going to cost us, well, I mean, not more than we could afford, obviously, because Trust is very rich, but more than we thought was reasonable to pay for it.
Yeah, but we have no money at the Freud Museum.
So we said, and this I think is really beautiful in the context, we said, okay, can we just have the rug, which covers the couch, right? And we'll make a mock-up of the couch, right? And we'll drape the rug over it, because who the fuck can tell? I mean, it's just like, it's got the same cover. And they said, sure, that's fine, you can have the rug, as long as you don't have the couch. So we got the rug on a couch that looks exactly like the couch. And, you know, inside, outside, superficial, what do you believe? I thought it was rather lovely in the end. Right. So you got the couch and we got the thing which everyone
thought
was
the couch.
Would
have been a lot better if you'd actually taken the couch and
only
we'd
if
made
you'd
some
no,
money.
Only if I hadn't told you that it wasn't the real one.
But I knew it wasn't the real one. Anyway, go on.
No, I was just thinking, so as a psychoanalyst, you're quite comfortable with the notion that we don't know what's going on inside our heads.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm also interested.
I still think
in
you want the scientist to tell you what's going on inside the head.
No, I don't know if I want the scientist, because I wouldn't put myself outside of a scientist. I would say it's the same kind of endeavour.
Okay.
So I wouldn't make that split. There's a problem because of the delegitimation of meanings, mm-hmm. and because of the history of the pharma companies, etc., that people are encouraged to think that you can procedurize the mind, right? And so even within a discipline like psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, you get this turn to, if I can say that this is driven by the amygdala. I mean, really, such naive stuff that you would die. Mm-hmm. That there is this terrible stuff of everybody turning themselves into neuro-speaking psychoanalysts. So I don't like that.
No, I get that. I spend some time debunking that, right? So people talk a lot about left brain, right brain, for example.
And, please tell everybody, because when I was writing Bodies, I came to talk to Dan about this left brain, right brain stuff, because I actually hated it and didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I was so thrilled. I thought, I'm really going to risk and ask if it's as bonkers an idea as it is. And actually it is. So could you please tell
me? Roughly speaking, so I mean, this is like, there's a brilliant guy called Chris McManus at UCL who wrote this book called Left Brain, Right Brain, which was, the cover is the Greek statue, because he was quite interested in the testicular asymmetry in Greek statues. And it turns out it's there, and as in people and so on. Several cool things about Chris. One is that he's been working on handedness and brainedness for, 15, 20 years. He's now got 6-year-old, I guess, if I'm correct me, girl twins, homozygotic, right, genetically identical girl twins. And it became clear around about age 3 that one of them was left-handed and the other was right-handed, despite their being genetically identical.
Yeah.
And, that was just like, wow, that is so cool. Like, if you've been studying that all your life and then you had twins and then they turned out to be left, that's just like, that is so interesting.
So were they lying in the womb with different,
That's holding, a really big research question.
I mean, are there early environmental influences?
Exactly. So people...
And how they were at the breast, excuse me? Mother.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, exactly.
I'm sorry. Think about the mother with each breast.
Yeah, yeah. My boss has twins, and when I brought my daughter along, and I said to her, she had two babies. And she went, oh, did you put one on one breast and the other on the other breast? She said, which I thought was exactly the right question. The point is, so there's this funny, what's the opposite of a kaleidoscope kind of thing about this? In other words, with left brain, right brain, the less you know about it, the clearer it is. I mean, a lot of things are like that. What's the connection? Can I do rude jokes at this time of the morning?
Yeah, cool.
What's the connection between Einstein's theory of general relativity and an erection? In both cases, the more you think about it, the harder it gets.
Okay, I think that's quite good, actually. Although, I think a physicist would say to you, the clarity of the simplicity. I'll let you have that.
So, I got an erection joke legitimised by a psychoanalyst.
Well, wait a minute. Weren't we supposed to be interested in sex until that dropped out after the Second World War? So, of course you're allowed to. And if I remember, I think your mother's in the field too, so you probably grew up with a lot of psychoanalyst jokes.
Actually, yeah, although she's a psychiatrist, but that's a different story. But anyway, although might or might not be.
Anyway,
come back
could
to
you
drugs.
Tell them about...
Yeah, left brain, right brain, the more you know about it, the less clear it is, right? So if you don't know anything about it, then it's that the right... Well, left brain, it's like, sensible thinking and ordered and stuff, and the right brain is all creativity, and when you do graduate school, it knocks out your right brain, so you're not creative, and we come back to scientific creativity and so on. And it turns out that just... there is no direct scientific evidence that would say anything like that. So it turns out that almost... there are lots of things which do seem to be lateralized. So particularly language, right? I mean, it's fairly clear for most of us that language is in the left part of the brain and the right part is sort of not that linguistic. But beyond that, any given experiment you do, like, spatial reasoning, you can get a lateralization phenomenon that's quite robust, but they don't really line up into a convincing story. We run a thing at the Wellcome Trust called narrative skills, right? We send our scientists onto narrative skills workshops to make them, firstly, help them to construct stories better, but then also, interestingly, it seems to me, thinking about the stories they're telling. And one of the things that scientists don't do very much is reflexivity, right? They don't think very much about their own practice. I think your comment about there being no science critics, right, like there are literary critics, was really interesting. Of course there are science critics. A major part of science scientific activity is peer review. So a working scientist will spend perhaps a quarter of her time criticizing the work of her peers because that's how papers get published. But the problem is that the critics are the scientists, indifferently so. I mean, they don't get any distance from themselves to look at themselves. It's all part of the same positivist story. Mm-hmm. It's all part of doing it. Mm-hmm. So what scientists lack is reflection, is thinking about the thing. So in the case of left brain, right brain, there is no good story about it once you get into the detail. There's a good story about it if you don't know anything, and it's that creativity is on the right and language is on the left. But that doesn't stand up. Right? It's a story which works until you meet the person in question, when it turns out that's all rubbish. But isn't that always the case when you hear stories about people and then you meet them and then they turn out to be more interesting?
But what you said to me that kind of helped is that even if you're going to take this story, that you're better off thinking about arrondissements than you are thinking about left brain, right brain. But the thing that I've never really understood is why would language not be considered a meaning-making? I mean, why is it considered the way in which you've just described it?
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, maybe I'll rephrase the question. I'm not sure I get it.
Well, when they talk about language being this active,
right,
left brain, was that a gong?
No.
Rational, whatever it is.
Wish fulfillment. Yeah.
I don't really. Yes. No fear. What I've never really understood is, particularly if you take Damasio's point, that thought requires emotion. Right. How it is that the neuroscientists can still talk about language right. as being something that's to do with thought rather than to do with affect.
Okay. Well, let me have a go at that. So Antonio Damasio is a neuroscientist or psychologist, and he talks a lot about emotion. I think the thing is, I mean, I'm not sure about him himself, in other words, what his own thoughts are, but I think he provokes some really interesting questions about thinking and being and doing. What we mean when we say language is lateralized is just this, that, well, a couple of things. You almost never cease to be able to speak as a result of a right brain injury. So again, you almost never cease to be able to speak as a result of a right brain injury, which is to say almost all of the brain injuries that give rise to lack of speech are left brain. So it seems it's in the left-hand side of the head. And also, if we do brain scans, which look where the blood energy, the energy in the blood, the oxygen is going, there's more of it in the left than in the right. So we kind of lateralize language in that sense. The meaning of language, though, probably needs both halves, of the head. But the meaning in what you think it always seems to me, again, is quite mysterious. I mean, back to the unbounded condition. What I mean by what I say, I often don't know. I mean, that's why I need people like you to help me understand what I mean. Right? I mean, it's not accessible to me. And I think one of the points that Damasio and others make is about embodied feeling. I mean, you know, I've said this to you before, but I only know I'm in love when I find myself outside someone's door at 3 a.m. for no apparent reason. I go, oh, I'm in love, that sort of thing. Or, you know, that's why I'm... Or that's why I was acting so strangely. I know I'm happy when I see myself smiling in the mirror. Right? I know I'm nervous when I feel it in the pit of my stomach. And the ways we talk about feeling and you know, our emotional lives are embodied. Right? I mean, that's the way we describe them. That's about language a bit, but it's also about where the feeling happens. It doesn't happen in the head. And so we work a lot with dancers in the lab that I was working
on. He's got the most beautiful experiment here.
We did some lovely experiments, which I may not have time to tell in detail, but I want to say a couple of things about it. Who is part of the conversation about the brain? Right? That's the question. Okay. And I'll give you a quick pencil sketch of how that went over the last 100 years. Right? For a long time, neuroscientists, and psychologists particularly, were behaviorists. Right? In other words, they explicitly said they weren't interested in what was going on inside the head. Right? The behaviorist joke, and back to sex, I'm afraid, but you know, two behaviorists in bed and one says the other.
You know, I will be interpreting this later.
I have no doubt.
But not on stage.
Two behaviorists in bed and one says the other, that was great for you, how was it for me? Right. So the behaviorists kind of they're not interested in what's going on inside the head, and as a neuroscientist for years we worked on brains in vats, literally in many cases, and then there were the people who were interested in inside the head and the outside. They never came together. Around 10-15 years ago, neuroscientists started to ask questions about memory and love and laughter and forgetting and creativity and so on. But one of the moves they made, which is a mistake, was to ignore all the people who've been thinking about these things all along. So again, at the ICA a few years ago, I did a thing called Four Perspectives on Consciousness. And I mean, this is a bit what I wanted to talk to Sophie about. You know, we had Sally Potter on visual consciousness because, you know, filmmakers understand how you put images together to make narrative, which depends on the visual system. We had Jonathan Miller as a theatre director because he knows how movements evoke feelings and thoughts. So he'll say move the arm to the right because then they'll think that you believe this. He knows the way that that movements generate feelings. And we had A.S. Byatt as the novelist because the novelist par excellence is the person who understands what subjective thought is. And the problem that we're at with neuroscience at the moment is that neuroscientists have said, right, we're in charge, everybody stop, let's do some Mickey Mouse experiment, a bit of brain imaging, we'll work out what's going on inside the head. You actually need the stories from the dancers about movement, from the novelists about thinking, to help us build and interpret the experiments. They don't be in the lab at the time of the experiment, but they need to help us build them and think about them afterwards.
So why don't you tell people about this fabulous experiment?
The dance one?
Yeah, because it's really lovely.
It is lovely, although it's kind of misinterpreted. Dear Ben Goldacre, deep fan of his work, has a redacted comment about it, where public engagement with science is literally... ballet dancers watching each other prance about in brain scanners. And I mean, that's literally what we did. But the reason why we did it is more interesting than Ben captures, I think. And so essentially what we were interested in as neuroscientists was what difference does it make when you see somebody doing something that you yourself can do, right? So I'll ask again, what difference does it make when you yourself see somebody doing something which you can do? So why is it that football commentators are usually former footballers, Right? What is it about having been a footballer that allows you to see it better? Okay. And we wanted to answer that question from a neurobiological perspective, but it became clear to us that the way to answer it was to work with dancers, okay? Because they do movement, they also see movement, and they're quite reflective. And so we did some cool experiments which compared different styles of dance. I mean, the coolest one, actually, again, talk about, there's a thing about creativity and science which I want to kind of respond to in the way of this. I mean, the difference between art and science, okay, what's the big difference between science and art is that scientists have salaries and artists don't. And that, you know, that's the only really big difference. All the other stuff is complicated. One of the reasons it's complicated is because, of course, scientists do creativity. That's how we come up with experiments. It took me 3 years to come up with the experiment, me, team of us, to come up with the experiment that I might have time to tell you about. The thing that is, though, that we're very uncomfortable with creativity as scientists, right? And we're uncomfortable about it for a number of reasons. One is because we're not reflexive. We don't think about what we do very much. We cut it out of our literature. If you read a science paper, there will never be any description of the creative process that gave rise to the experiments. Not that it didn't happen, it's just censored out. And the real problem is, for scientists, everything needs to be reproducible.
Well, certain kinds of science. You wouldn't have that in paleontology, so I don't accept that as an argument.
Well, you find one instance of a fossil, but you have to believe that the next door fossil would look the same, it just didn't happen to survive. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, if it were a particular fossil...
I don't think you should go down that route. I think that really weakens your argument.
Do you?
I don't think that's why you don't claim creativity. I think it's all... It must have to do with the transfer to funding. It must have to do with the end of the 19th century notion that we could know literature and science and the division. And listen, I've been around a lot of scientists, and they really are reflective about their work. Maybe it's in the neuroscience field that, unless you're exceptional and you work in a lab where it's possible to do this kind of reflection, I think maybe it doesn't happen in at least as the work comes down to us in the public. It looks like some of you are really smart and some of you are really very narrowly minded. So I'm not
really?
Sure. Yeah.
But I think there's some really smart ones who don't understand, have no idea what they're doing. Right, in the reflexive sense. Being reflexive is having an idea of what
you're doing. Yeah, that's interesting. You must know more of them than I do.
Well, mathematicians, just for starters.
No, I think they absolutely love their work. I think they're really very, very interested in the kinds of relationships that they're creating between numbers and shapes. But maybe, again, I know the sexy ones. I mean, because it isn't my experience. I have never met... They may not know how to dress...
Marcus de Soto looks okay in my view.
They may not know how to do some of... They might... Okay, this is terrible. They might be slightly socially autistic. But when they come to talk about their work, I think the kind of passion that they have, if you are interested, shows great deal of reflexivity.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you have a better view of my peers in some ways than I do. But,
yeah. Yeah, but excuse me, look where you're... I mean, I know you're in the best possible place, but you are also connected to Wellcome. I presume there are some people there that work on some bit of creating product, which is very different than what you're trying to do in the short term. You're trying to think, right?
I guess so. But, I mean, again, the question for me, and it's sort of back to the creative writing question, you know, what are the conditions which can best bring about the best writing, the best science? You know, we're talking about education again. And I'm not convinced... that reflexivity is always a good idea. I mean, I was horrified. My dad was a chemist for many years, right, an industrial chemist, and then at 55 he got early retirement. And he'd done sculpture at the Ruskin when he was doing chemistry at Oxford. Retired at 55 and went back to art college, you know, and did a foundation, and then a bachelor's and then a master's at Chelsea and John Cass and all that. And I was horrified by the amount of criticism that these really early stage artists were being encouraged to do. You know, even at first degree level, the idea that if the goal is to produce great work... Incidentally, I think you guys missed the thing about, you know, you're talking about perfectibility of bodies and then also about creativity and children and are we all creative or not creative in the post-war contracts and all stuff. I think Photoshop in some ways is the common element, right? I mean, in the days where you just drew stuff, then you could feel, you felt very differently as a kid about what you produced than, you know, now on CBeebies, for those of you who watch it, all of the birthday cards that get sent in for kids that get held up and shown have had the life photoshopped out of them. I mean, what they've done is they've gone onto the CBeebies website, they've cut out, you know, printed out and cut out a character, they've photoshopped a picture of the kid and stuck it on. And that's what a child's work or work about a child's supposed to look like. So it seems to me that the technology which allows us to allow bodies to look perfect also makes us think that our personal creative products ought to be perfect right off the bat.
Yeah, I don't have
You're a proto-novelist and you write a few paragraphs and you print them out on beautiful white paper, perfectly formatted. God, I mean, that must be awful, you know, compared with just writing out on a notebook, because it's supposed to look perfect and finished, and that must
make
you feel
terrible. We're
back to
bullet points, but I think that's true. And I wouldn't want to say that Photoshop wasn't extremely creative. I think of course it's a technology that people are using and young people are using in a different way. And actually, I think I probably should have said to Jeanette, I don't actually think they are perfect bodies, those bodies. I think they are simply constructions, and they're a current aesthetic that's terribly narrow and not very nice. Somehow we've lost your dance experiment.
I can tell you. All right. So, weirdly enough, a friend of mine introduced me to a woman whose husband is a fencer, and it turned out we for ages thought we were going to be working on her. So the interesting thing about her is that she goes to a lot of fencing matches, right? But she has never picked up a foil. Right? So she sees lots of it and probably gets it, but she's never done it. So she was the perfect candidate for us. Maybe by watching enough of it, you can build the structures in your head that the people who do it have as well. Maybe you don't need to do it. Maybe if you just watch it. And we struggled for ages because there's a thing called a crossover design. You need things to work both ways for it to be scientifically testable.
Is that five?
I got 30 seconds more on this one, so we can come up with another thing. So all we did was we took male and female ballet dancers in the classical tradition because we noticed that there are some moves that only the women do and only the men. For the women, it's mostly on point, stuff they do that the men don't. Ignoring Matthew Bourne, right? It had to be very classically trained. And unpoisoned by contemporary choreography. For the blokes, it's the big leaps they do that the women don't. But because they train in a mixed-sex environment, in a mixed-gender environment, they're watching the male and the female moves equally, right? It's just that they only do the gendered ones. They're androgynous moves as well. And so we're done. We work with a choreographer. We filmed lots of these things. We put them in the brain scanner. We compared, as a bloke, when you're watching a big leap, which you can do and see a lot, when you're watching some stuff on point, which you can't do, but you do see a lot. Right? So then we're able to factor out the difference of doing. And it turns out the difference of doing makes a big difference. Right? That's all. I mean, roughly speaking, you use the bit of your brain that controls movement to help you see. Right? But I don't know, Susie, for you, right? I'll tell you this, it's not a Mickey Mouse story, it's a very cool story. It's a cool story about neuroscience that we answered using dancers because that was the way to do the experiment. And it's a cool story, it's a beautiful experiment, and it's nice. Is there anything that you as an analyst in your work can do with understanding something like that? I mean, in the 3 minutes remaining. But, Jim, what is the relevance of a scientific story like that to people like you who actually make a difference in people's heads, as opposed to people like me that are parasitic?
Well, I don't think you're parasitic, and I'm not really sure we needed that self-deprecation there, but we'll discuss that later.
I love it with Susie because you always got fuel for the next conversation in time. Yes.
I think the thing that I would say is that I know that certain words that arise in my head when I'm sitting with somebody, if I give voice to those words, have the likelihood of producing a different way of that person settling inside of them. Does that make sense?
It does.
They're not the same words, but they're the same kind of register. So I suppose if one was wanting to technologize psychoanalysis, you could say that this kind of situation means that you could reach for this kind of words or statement, and that would allow for the person. So
here's the thing. It's a funny old thing. I think it's fantastic and exciting that people like you want to understand what I do in terms of as a brain scientist. I've been in the lab for a couple of years now, but as a brain scientist. But I'm really deeply skeptical, also in the education domain, as a matter of fact, about whether anything we've understood in brain science in the last 10 years could in practice actually help anything that you do. Although I'm sure if you believe it does, it will, right? I mean, there's a kind of psychological placebo effect. If you believe that understanding the brain helps you be a better analyst or a better analysand, that's fine, but it's actually not a literal connection.
I think I'm part of the tendency that doesn't like that,
right,
but is very relieved there's some confirmation, okay? I think the thing that really did interest me, which is the experiment before your experiment, which is the seeing-doing Rizzoletto mirror neuron system.
Yep.
I thought that was very, very interesting in terms of my trying to understand how we get a body. Because that's been part of my intellectual project, is to understand that the body doesn't just unfold as a series of instructions, as a bit of DNA, that actually we know how we get a mind, or we have ideas at least about how we get a mind, but we don't really consider least if you're from where I'm sitting, how we get a body, and that therefore I was drawn to a piece of neuroscience because I thought something about observation, creating a neural structure where you already have the seeing has something to do with doing.
Yeah. Well, the thought is there are structures in the head that relate directly your own body to the body you watch. These are mirror neurons. And what it turns out is that your own body is constructed out of the bodies you see around you. And that's sort of true in kind of a literal neural sense, that your own body representation
right,
is
so
driven.
Right, so that fits perfectly if you're a relational psychoanalyst who believes that who you are has to do with your early relationships. And the possibility of who you can be has to do with what can happen in contemporary relationships.
Sure.
What's happening right here is transformative for me. There's
a great Jonathan Miller story, which I'm guessing is going to get gonged, but Jonathan Miller, you know phantom limbs, right? So people who have amputations, turns out, still have itches in the limb that's gone. And the limb in which they have the itch is called the phantom limb, right? That's the one that's no longer there. And one sentence more of Miller's. He says it's not that the phantom limb appears after the amputation. He says we've all got phantom limbs all the time. It's just that we don't notice the phantom one till the real one's gone. Right?
Yeah.
We make our bodies from the inside.
Okay.